Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Sober Indian Wednesday Night Live. I want to welcome everybody to the show. It's going to be a really good show this evening, very interesting. I want to introduce Derek. So with that being said, hello, Derek. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Karen. How are you this evening?
Thanks. I'm doing pretty good. I'm anxious to talk to you and learn more about your story, and I'm just going to let you take it from here and tell everybody about you and how your journey began and your road to recovery.
Okay. Well, I think it begins, first of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity and this platform. For the opportunity to speak to everyone about my journey, and because my journey is all of our journey. You know, it's a journey of alcoholism. It's a journey of poisonous substances and how we've allowed that alcohol and those poison substances to take hold of our lives and to change the fabric of our lives and to destroy any vestiges of striving to get to our destiny as men and women, you know, especially in the indigenous population. I come from a big family, 14 on my father's side, 9 on my mother's side. My father, bless his heart, is Seminole and Siksika. Blackfoot Indian. My mother's side came from, a serious Cherokee background as well, and a Chickamauga background as well. So I grew up in a very deep indigenous background in the 50s. I was born in 1956, June 28th, 1956, and I am the firstborn male of my father, who's also was a very important leader in the Seminole community down in Florida, Georgia, and the whole entire northeastern area in the early years. My grandfather was a Seminole chief, and so I came out of a very interesting background where we were not Christians. We grew up understanding tribal spirituality, and that's how I have to say it in these modern times. I came up in a tribal atmosphere, and so we were not Christians, and we were not comfortable with Christianity, we'll say that, but we were comfortable being spiritual and understanding our traditions. And I came out of a background where our traditions were held on to with great respect and honor of that time. I will say this, a part of that history is that from my grandfather and all of the other men, they fought in probably every theater of war in the North Americas, from the Revolutionary War to the Seminole Indian Wars. So I've always joked around. I've always said, I thank God for my relatives, because they knew how to stick and move, shoot the jab, duck, do whatever they had to do. They were great warriors, because if they didn't do what they did, I would not be here able to talk to anybody tonight. So I come from a very strong indigenous background, but I noticed in that background that there was a lot of moonshine. There was a lot of homemade whiskey, homemade bourbons. I noticed that the folks, there's a lot of the members of my family were what they call today, I guess they call them closet drunks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you're a young boy growing up and you're running around the land and having fun with your cousins and the other, boys and girls in the tribe, and you're running around, you see certain things, but of course you're not aware of anything. And of course, you know, my grandmother, my father's mother, she was a healer. And so she mm-hmm. didn't touch any alcohol. My grandfather was not a alcoholic. He did not drink because of his attitude and his position in the tribe. But there were other members of the family and the tribe who were definitely involved in heavy drinking at that time. And I remember as a youngster watching and listening to a lot of arguments going on about that. I noticed that some of the alcohol was so severe. I noticed as a young boy how it affected these lives. But, you know, Karen, I never thought in my life that it would happen to me. I never thought that I would have this terrible, horrific life that would take place because of of drinking and of course getting involved in drugs. You know, I noticed that as I was getting older, my father, him and my mom had decided that they were going to push north and for opportunity, to gain access to a better income because they wanted to make something of themselves. They had wanted to do certain things. My father was a baseball player in the Negro Baseball League. There was a lot of indigenous men who were ball players in the Negro Leagues. My father was mm-hmm. one of those all-stars. He was like a superstar in the Negro Leagues. He played for the Indianapolis Clowns. He played for the Philadelphia Stars. He played for the Kansas City Monarchs. He was really good. And because I think of the baseball, that was another reason why they wanted to go up north, because of the games. And so, of course, my mother and him, they went up north, got married, and then after me was my sister Kathy came in. And so now there was two of us. And so moving up north, my father was able to get a job as a tool and die. They call him a tool and die man. He worked for Boeing Airlines, got a good job working for Boeing Airlines, making airline parts and doing that thing. The story is so big, I'm trying to condense it because I need to get to my story. But just to lay a foundation, you know, my parents moved to New Jersey, and I have to tell you, I hated everything about New Jersey. I did not want to move to New Jersey, and I landed up going to the school system in New Jersey, which I also didn't like. But my father was, you know, wanted to work, and my mother also got a job. We had other relatives who had migrated to New York and New Jersey and the tri-state area. And so that was the beginning of the journey. And I noticed when we got there, I also noticed alcoholism. You know, my family, both sides of my family were very gregarious. They were very social family. There was always parties. You know, there was always social functions. There was always barbecues. The family moved as one. If one moved on say a Walnut Street in Elizabeth, New Jersey, 9 times out of 10, other family members moved nearby, you know? And so if we were going out to down the shore for the day, 9 times out of 10, we had other people in the family going with us. So I was never alone. You know, we always traveled to various different places. We always visited family in Oklahoma because of, you know, the various different social functions, indigenous social functions there. We also, I have relatives in Alberta, Canada, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, indigenous family members who lived up there. So we were always traveling, you know, around North America. We were always traveling somewhere, and I always saw people drinking, you know, not realizing mm-hmm. that one day that it was going to happen to me. And, of course, when you're a young boy, you're curious, and so, you know, I would ask, you know, an uncle or cousin, hey, let me try this. Oh, hey, let me try that, you know. And they would slip me, you know, a glass of gin or a glass of whiskey. Or, you know, my father used to enjoy, he used to get this stuff called Old Granddad. My father, he used to get this this thing called Old Granddad. It was like the biggest proof that you can find on the market. And he would add a little milk in it on the rocks. And then he would have a shot of that while he, you know, was, you know, working or doing something in the yard or something. And my mother's big thing was vodka and or gin. And she liked my mother was bad. My mother was she loved her bourbon. She was straight to it. Both of my parents were big partiers, big social butterflies. They loved going out. We'd have a relative stick with my sister Kathy and I while they went out to have a good time, and they would always come back, you know, high, or should I say drunk, you know. And they were good drunks. They weren't bad drunks, you know. You know how some people are just like bad drunks and get into fights? Not my parents. My parents were laughing, giggling. They would close the master bedroom door, you know, make love, and, you know, and they, you could hear them laughing and giggling and having a good time. So on that end, it was okay. But again, the choices that I made for myself, you know, and I could remember both of my parents saying, hey, don't do what we're doing. Don't be like us. Be your own person. Don't follow up behind us. Don't do it, you know. And, you know, my father was a, you know, like I said, I'm cutting the story really in half because of time. But my father was a good man. He died in 1993. He raised up six of us. And him and my mom had a great relationship. But, again, the alcohol in the family was a detriment to everything that was going on. I made the choice, not my mother, not my father, to drink, you know. And as I got more in with my own friends, you know, I had a gambling habit because I was I became a hustler because I was following up behind the pimp and the gangsters, you know, that I had met in New York and New Jersey, and I was trying to emulate them. You know, and so I would be sneaking out, hanging out with them. I would be playing cards, running billiard tables. I was doing all sorts of things. And, of course, I saw people shooting heroin. I saw people snorting cocaine. I saw people, you know, doing all kinds of drugs, marijuana, heavy-duty drinking. You know, as I was getting older, as I turned like about 11 or 12, I found myself hustling, you know, pool. I was, you know, I was playing cards with older cats. They were allowing me in because I had a good attitude about the cards. I had a good attitude about the billiards. And, of course, where was it? It was drinking. It was a lot of drugs. You know, a lot of the older guys that I was hanging out with, they weren't allowing me to do any heroin, but they allowed me to smoke some weed. They, you know, allowed me to have some alcohol in my Coca-Cola or my ginger ale, you know, and that was the beginning point. See, that was the start, you know, and before I realized, as I started getting older, I realized one of the worst things that I could ever I remember was hanging out in front of Victory Liquor Store on Jefferson Avenue in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and I was asking some of the older guys, could you go in there and get me a bottle of vodka? you know. And so here I am, 15, with this money in my pocket, and I'm asking the older guys, hey, man, I'll give you this money if you just go out and get me a bottle of vodka, you know. And so they would go in, you know, and get me a bottle of vodka, and, of course, I would go out into the woods, and I would go, it would go straight to my lips. I would go straight to my lips. And that was one of those moments when I was in trouble. They used to have these things called violets. And violets were this thing that smokers used when they wanted to mask their cigarette or marijuana smoke. And so I use the violets and any type of mints that I can get, you know, to mask the alcohol that I was swilling. So when I would come home, I thought I was getting away with things. My parents weren't stupid, you know. My parents knew that I was drinking. You know, they knew that I was hustling pool and playing cards. They knew I was hanging out with the pimps and the gangsters and all the players. And they knew that I was getting involved in activity that was not conducive to my family. You know, my family wanted me to go to college, university, get an education, make something of myself. You know, I would be the first person in my family to go to school, to go to university, to college. You know, my parents had great dreams for me. They had great dreams for my sister, Kathy. Then Carla came. And then, of course, after Carla came Diane. After Diane came my sister, Cindy. But to say that was that they had great expectations for me, but I made the choice to do something else with my life. I wanted to be a gangster. I wanted to be a bad guy. I didn't want to be spiritual. I didn't want to have the spiritual walk that I learned from my great aunt Night Owl, who's the healer, and my grandfather, you know, who was a great Seminole chief who had great expectation for me. He shared so much with me as a child, and I tossed it all away to follow up behind these other guys that I admired. You know, learned about guns and learned about hustling money, and you know, conning people and running games on people. And I was good at it. I was really, really good at it, you know. But my parents, I loved them so much, I tried not to get myself into any scraps until when I was 16 years old. I was at this party playing poker with a group of guys, and the cops kicked in the door. And they had the guns drawn out. There was marijuana in the air and cocaine and heroin and all sorts of stuff. And here I am, a 16-year-old boy, in the middle of a situation that clearly was going to work against me. They sent me off to juvenile, and I sat in this cell. And I can tell you, Karen, I did not like that cell. I did not want to be there, you know. And, of course, when you're in a cell, I don't know about any other sober Indians. I don't know about anybody else, but I was not feeling that whole process of being in that cell, you know. And my father came and got me. And on that moment, my father, he didn't say a word. He didn't say a word. The police officer, if I remember correctly, he said to me, he says, "You're one lucky young man." He says, "We're going to let you go. We're not going to file any charges because you just happened to be there. You know, they didn't find any drugs on me, thank God. You know, the only thing I had was, you know, the alcohol in me that I was drinking." And so I don't know what my father, to this day, I don't know what my father did. I don't know what he said, but I know when I got back in that car to go home, my father didn't say a word. He didn't say a word. I was scared out of my mind because my father and I had always had a great relationship. You know, I never gave him any cause to, you know, punish me for anything. Not that I didn't do mischief as a kid. I did. But it was always, Derek, stop it. Hey, Derek, come here. Stop. Don't do that again. You know, it was never that, that you know, bad relationship where he had to haul off and knock me out or do anything like that. But on this particular day, I was scared out of my mind. And we didn't drive straight home. He drove me down. We went to the shore. In fact, we went to this place called Asbury Park, New Jersey. Got out of the car and I followed him out to the beach and we sat on the sand and he sat me down and he said to me, he says, you know, I can be the kind of a father who just hauls off and just knock you out. I said, I can be the kind of a father that punishes you and tries to tell you what you shouldn't do and how you shouldn't do this and how you shouldn't do that. But I can't do that because I was a hellion. I was bad. I was doing things that I wasn't supposed to do, and I was being groomed to take over as chief, you know, for the tribe. Mm-hmm. And here I am. What am I going to do? Try to tell you, don't drink, don't do this, don't do that, when I was doing probably a lot worse than you. I said, I look at you, I see myself. When I look at you, I saw me when I was your age. And my father did the same thing I'm doing to you, talk to you, because I am banking on the fact that I'm appealing to your intellect, that I'm appealing to your brilliant mind. You're smart. You've just made a choice. I said, and clearly you learned something from the choice you made. And I said, it's going to be up to you to make decisions that's going to impact the rest of your life. I says, after your mother and I leave this dimension of life, you are going to be here. You're going to be a tribal leader. You're going to be able to encourage and to uplift and to point people in the right direction to do the things they need to do in their own lives. People are going to come to you for guidance. They're going to come to you for something that may help them to encourage them on their own path. I said, but for me to lock you in the room or to take this away, and to do, I'm not doing it because that means I'm a hypocrite. My father didn't do it, and I'm not going to do it for you. Now let's go get some ice cream. And I, Karen, I'm telling you, 16 years old, my father said those words, and those words hit me upside the head. We got the ice cream, and he says, Derek, he says, you can do anything you put your mind to do, but you have made the decision to put your mind to want to be a gangster. I said, and every gangster that I've met, when we've barnstormed with the leagues, I know all the gangsters, I know all the pimps, I know all the pushers, I know all the jazz musicians, I know all the artists, I know them all. I said, and all of these jokers who were out there doing those drugs either died or landed up penniless. I said, you don't want that for yourself. You know, 16 years old, Karen, I took those words, okay? And I got myself back into school. I started working toward my grades. I know I became a college prep, you know, student in junior high and high school, but I could not get away from the drinking. I started smoking weed. I couldn't get away from the cards in the pool. I couldn't get away from it. It was like I didn't know anything about addiction. I didn't know anything about being obsessed. I didn't know anything about, you know, what the mind can do if you affirm certain things. I didn't realize. And so here I am on one side of my brain, I'm doing great in school, but on the other side, I'm a hot mess, man. I was out there doing things I shouldn't have been doing. By 17, 18, I was heading toward graduation from high school. I ran track. Can you imagine? Here I am. I'm a drinker. I'm an alcoholic. At 17, smoking weed, and I was running track in high school. I ran cross country and outdoors. You see what I'm saying? And I was involved in the martial arts. Could you imagine that? I was involved in the martial arts, running track, doing all this stuff, and sneaking weed and alcohol on the side and trying to mask it with Listerine. And then, of course, you know, if you're smoking weed, you want to put on a little cologne, you know, and thinking that I was doing something. Nope, I wasn't doing anything. I was only fooling myself. And the universe conspired to allow me to go to college. You know, first one in my family to ever go to college. And I go into college as an undergraduate, and I exceeded the expectations, but college experience was great. But on the other side, the social aspect of college darn near killed me, because in college at the time, there was a lot of cocaine, there was a lot of weed. There were students that were popping mescaline. And they were doing all kinds of uppers and downers and speeds. And other times it was speed and, you know, mescaline and stuff. And, of course, you know, after you study, you had to go. We went to the parties in New York where we danced the night away. You know, the clubs were big happening. They had the Paradise Garage and the Electric Circus and Studio 54. And I got involved in all that stuff. And it was a lot of drinking, a lot of drugging, a lot of partying. And one night I was in this place called the Mud Club in New York. And I was going to the bathroom, and there was a guy in there. He was shooting up. He had just shot up, and I watched this guy. I had seen it before. But on this particular evening, it impacted me. And I remember helping this guy. He was slumped. He slumped over on the toilet. And I remember getting him together, and I was able to get him out of the men's room, and I sat him in a chair. I called security to come over and get him. And by that time, the guy had died. The security guard said, "Man, do you know this guy?" I said, "No, man, I just went to go to the bathroom, and this guy was shooting up, and, you know, I didn't know he took a hot dose." And that's another situation, like the 16-year-old situation with the cops kicking in the door. That impacted me.
Mm-hmm.
Crack was big. Crack took control of everything. People went from freebasing to doing crack. And crack was the worst thing possible. Could you imagine drinking and smoking crack, freebasing, and doing mescaline and all these other things? Well, crack scared the heck out of me.
No.
If heroin scared me, crack scared the living daylights out of me. You know, I tried crack one time, and it took control. And I promised myself, there is no way that I'm going to ever do track. Crack, in fact, it was crack that led me to the road of recovery, you know, because crack scared the heck out of me so badly that I didn't want anything anymore, you know. And it was tough. It took me 2.5 years, 2.5 years to get to the point where the only thing I was drinking was probably a glass of wine. I ended all of my relationships with people that I knew. I had no choice. I had to end those relationships because I realized that if I didn't end those relationships, I was never going to graduate, you know, from college, and I didn't want to disrespect all the hard work and effort my parents had put into me. They spent a lot of money. They're raising six kids. And so I was the first one in my family to go to college. And, of course, my sister Kathy, she wanted to go to school. My sister Carla, she wanted to go to university. And so they were looking up to me. And so whatever I was doing was going to impact them. And then, of course, I had the people in the tribe, the people in my family, relatives looking at me, you know. And so I had a great responsibility that I didn't realize I had. And so that crack scared the heck out of me. People that I knew and I loved were dying from crack. Crack was taking control of people's lives. People who had never did a drug or alcohol in their lives, they got a hold of that crack and they became absolute. You see those television, The Walking Dead? It reminded me of that. It reminded me of that. I saw people that I knew. I went to funeral after funeral after funeral, and I remember one of my uncles, he said to me, he said, you know, I had a dream one night that you were in one of those boxes. Because I know you, Derek. Wow. I know that you are out there and you're running deep and running hard. He says, brother, I said, Unc loves you, but all I know is that I have the gift of discernment and you have the opportunity now to change your life around. I said, I can't tell you what to do, but I hope you do it. And that impacted me a lot. And then it was my third year of college. Karen, I went to this party that I should not have went to. And in that party, there was so much drinking. And, of course, you're with the boys. You're going to pull shots. You're going to drink shots. Now, you have to remember, I had tried to tone down my drinking down to a level of just wine. Well, not on this particular night. I got with the fellas, and we were shooting. We were doing shot after shot after shot, snorting cocaine. We were out there party-hardy. We had the girls. We out there party-hardy-hardy, just doing it up. And then somebody dropped some mescaline in the daggone punch, and then I was done. The next thing I know, dear friend of mine, I thank him to this day. He's a retired, in fact, it's funny. It's funny to say this, but he's a retired state trooper, dear friend of mine. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for him, he got me back to my dorm room, and the next thing I know, I found my head down in the toilet bowl. And everything that I had drank, you know what I'm saying, was coming up out of me. That was another thing that impacted me. There's nothing worse than when your head is in the toilet bowl, And you can't stop throwing up, and then you throw up to the point where it's dry, and you're still throwing up. And then I got a fever, and so I remember that he put me in my dorm bed, and my roommate and him made sure that I had hot and cold compresses and toweled me down because my blood pressure had dropped to such a significant level, my body was completely drenched. You see what I'm saying? And I was about to die. That night I was about to die because of alcohol and drugs, you know. And I remember my man said to me, he said, Derek, you were begging me not to take you to the hospital. He said, Derek, you were begging me not to take you to the hospital. I said, but I just knew you had to go to the hospital. They took me to the hospital and pumped my stomach out and saved my life. Wow. To this day, I thank him. He lives in L.A. now, but I thank him to this. Every time we just talked this past holiday, great to hear from him. And I thank him to this day. And that was the beginning of the turn. You know, I never went to an AA meeting, but there was these two sisters that were a part of my crew, and they started going to church And they were going to this Pentecostal church in Newark, New Jersey. And I was like, where the heck y'all been? They said, you look bad, Derek. You need to come to church with us. I was like, I ain't going to no daggone church. You know, I ain't going to nobody's church. But they kept egging me on, come on, come on, come on. So I let them go into church. And, of course, they sat me down. He sat me down right in the front pew of this church in Newark, New Jersey. Full gospel, Pentecostal church. Pastor Bishop Stacy McQueen. Oh, my God. I ain't been in nobody's church in my daggone life. You know, we believed in, you know, prayer and ceremony. We believed in something else. But here I am in this church. And, of course, the bishop is talking about me in this church. And he says, is anybody here after the service, after he talked about me in the church, in a full congregation, anybody want to give their life to Christ? I did not get up. I was not giving my life to nothing, you know. And he came after the end of the service. He said, brother, just for you coming out to church, you know, it says, you know, your friends talked a great deal about you, and they're so glad that you came into the house of the Lord. And I remember my grandfather telling me the story about how one of our ancestors, when the pioneers and the frontiersmen and the missionaries came to Turtle Island, to North America, you know, that we were dispatched to learn the white man's language, the Anglo-Saxon language, and learn everything about this Bible that they keep trying to present. We were killing. My people were killing ministry. We were killing. You know, we were killing the black robes. Just put it this way. We weren't feeling it. And so now one of my relatives was dispatched to learn. He started learning not only French, but he learned the British English. And they started deciphering. It took him 5 years to ascertain. And from the meetings that my grandfather was, he said, in those meetings, said they learned how what we believed was far more advanced than what the white man had for us. And so why should we involve ourselves in the white man's ways and continue to adhere to our own ways? To make a long story short, you know, in 1984, I remember going to church, and my parents never gave their lives to Christ because of the traditional background, but I had made the decision to give my life to Christ. I did it because I wanted to discover certain things. Giving my life to Christ, accepting Christ as my personal Lord and Savior, 1984, and then I was baptized in water. I went through the process of baptizing in water, which for me in that church was a 3-month lesson process. And when I did that, I cannot state to this day I adhered to the principles of the Bible or the principles of Christianity. I felt like my ancestor, who was on that 5-year discovery of learning the French and the white man's English, you know, and Dutch and some other languages, I felt like I was the embodiment of that ancestor by learning about baptism, learning about Christianity, learning everything it is about Christianity. I also discovered Islam. I also went to the Jewish temple. I also met with some Krishnas and some Buddhists. I learned a lot of different religions. I learned the principles and the tenets of a lot of those religions. And a lot of people think that I'm a Christian today. I don't ever say that I'm a Christian. I say that I'm spiritual, you know. Mm-hmm. And I respect the word of God. I respect his word because the word of God is what my ancestors believed long before the white man's Bible. To say that, to say this, all of the things that I learned helped me lay a deeper spiritual foundation and also grounded me in the attitude that there was a bigger responsibility. my fourth year of college, I was throwing around the frisbee and going to martial art tournaments and swimming and stuff because I had graduated in 3.5 years. And so I had the room all paid for. I had everything done. My relatives and tribe had spent all this money. So by the fourth year, I was completely off of any alcohol. I stopped smoking reefer. I stopped smoking cocaine. I stopped playing cards, and I stopped going to the billiard halls, and I stopped. And I decided that I was going to leave the United States of America. I had an opportunity in Japan to teach martial arts, and I was going to go over there to teach martial arts, and then I met my wife.
Oh, wow.
And it was my wife, my Caribbean lovely wife, who changed, was another part of that opportunity for me, because she didn't drink. She never did any drugs. She was not a partier. And she was going to an Assemblies of God church in Roselle, New Jersey. And I left the Pentecostal church to be with her at the Assemblies of God church. And see, God has a sense of humor. God has a sense of humor. I landed up teaching Bible study, you know. And I remember coming home, my mother was laughing out of her mind. My mother couldn't tell. She goes, "You're teaching Bible study." I said, "Oh, my God, the ancestors are rolling." I could hear the ancestors. They're just rolling. They're crying with laughter right now. And here I am at this church. I'm teaching Bible study. And, of course, the minister would have me get up to speak to the congregation. And people started calling me, you know, they thought that I was a pastor. They thought I was a minister. But what that was teaching me is that I had my sisters and my younger brother, Carl. They started saying, "Thank you, you know, we admire you and we love you." And then, of course, I had, because it's almost time to go, but I have nieces and nephews. I have godchildren. You know, the Great Spirit blessed me to be a grandfather, soon to be a great-grandfather. My wife and I have been together for over 30-something years now. Still, we have a beautiful relationship. I haven't touched a drop of alcohol, snorted a drop of cocaine, done any reefer since giving my life to Christ in 84. And so I met Patrick McCoy on Facebook. We became real good friends. I really was admiring what Patrick was talking about. He had this vision for this group called Sober Indians, and he opened his mouth and started speaking life about the mission statement and the values. He started talking to me about the ideas that he had for the group, and it just touched my heart to have even though I've never met him in person like that, but we began to share through the inbox. You know, we started sharing. He started showing me what he wanted to do. He started sharing his ideas and showing me what he wanted to do. And then he invited me to be the vice president of the group. And at that time in the group, there was not a lot of members. There was not a lot of members of the group. We were a small group at the time, and that group went from nothing to over 70,000 something plus people now. And we encourage people. We uplift people. And the members encourage one another. And we have all kinds of people of every kind of background. There's indigenous people who are Christians. There are people that are traditional. There are people that are still going through in their journey. And some of them are making, they're falling down and getting back up, and they're falling down and getting back up, and they're fighting for their freedom. They're fighting just for the integrity of themselves and for the future of their families. What was happening to me was generational. This scourge of alcohol was generational in my family. And I remember sitting in church one day, and the pastor of the church was saying, and I was visiting the church, he says, it's generational. And it hit me. I said, yes, this thing has been going on for centuries, and it ends with me right now. Because I got nieces, nephews, godchildren, grandchildren, pretty soon great-grandchildren, godchildren, family members, tribal members. I have responsibility to three different tribes now. You know, I'm on the council of three different indigenous tribes today. I'm the vice president of Sober Indians. You know, I am a professional visual artist of renown. I represent my family and my tribe and my children, especially my wife. So I'm grateful for what the Great Spirit, the kind one, has done for me, for the journey that I've been on, for the fight that I had to deal with. There was one time I had such a bad habit with the cocaine. I got on the subway. I got on the Northeast Corridor train from Elizabeth, New Jersey, went all the way down to Harlem, got me a bag of cocaine, came all the way back to Elizabeth, New Jersey, into my apartment. And because I felt so guilty, I took and I flushed the cocaine down the toilet. And then no sooner than I flushed it down the toilet, Karen, I looked at the time, and I got back on the train the same night. I took the last Northeast Corridor train, got on the subway, the A train to Harlem, went and got another bag of cocaine. Okay? And I was able to get the train going back. I got all the way back to the apartment, and I started to cry because I knew that I was done. I was wrong. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Stories like that. The journey for all of us are difficult. Some of us have tried to commit suicide on this journey. Some of us have had terrible family relationships with mothers and fathers. Some of us were in theaters of war and came back, you know, not whole, and thought they can drown themselves in alcohol and drugs. Here's a myriad of things that have happened to the sober Indians. I can go on and on and on about this. This is a terrible thing that's going on in our world today. But I'm grateful for the opportunity to be involved, you know, with the peacekeepers and the other administrators of this great group. I am so happy that the Great Spirit has blessed me with the opportunity to participate in this group, because nothing is more pleasing to me when I can uplift and encourage others, or I can share my testimony, or I could virtually hug somebody and let them know, I know exactly what you're going through. I know exactly where you've been. You know, I had a situation when I was gambling. The guy put the gun. He put a .38 in my mouth. I was 13 years old, and I was winning the hands. I was drunk out of my mind, and this guy took his gun and he wanted his money. He put that gun, he cocked that trigger, and I told him to do it. He said, because I'm so high right now, I won't even feel the bullet. You know? See, that's another little part of the journey, you know? And people are like, Derek, you need to write a book. You need to write a book. Maybe one day I will. But to tell you now, to have a great relationship with my wife, to have a wonderful relationship with my children. My children didn't see daddy drinking. They didn't see daddy smoking. They heard about it. You know, they heard stories about me. You know, I didn't bring that home to my wife. I didn't bring that home to my children. My grandchildren will never see it. My great-grands will never know about it. And when they put me in that ground, you know, they're going to say, you know, they're going to tell the stories. They're going to tell the things that have happened to me on this journey, you know. But we're in this thing together. I pray for all the sober Indians right now. I pray for each and every one of us because we're getting ready to go into a New Year situation. We got this COVID-19 thing with two new strains coming. And so a lot of us are forced to be in the house. A lot of us are dealing with things on the reservation. I visited people on the reservation. And some of these reservations are absolutely, makes you want to cry when you see what's going on in a lot of these reservations in North America. The alcoholism and the poisonous substance abuse is rampant. It's horrific, killing us every single day. And it's happened long before COVID-19. And it's not going to stop until we just continue to work toward getting as many people as we can to understand that there's a better way of life that they could have for themselves. But you got to fight with everything you got, everything you can muster. You know, so if it's Jesus, hallelujah. If it's Allah, great. If it's the Great Spirit, fine. If it's the kind one, great. If it's Buddha, okay. Whatever's working for you, whatever's going to get you there, do it. You know, because there's nothing more. End the generational curse in your families. End the generational curses in your tribes. End it. So as we push toward the present and into tomorrow's to come, we can do what our ancestors did before the white man showed up. And I'm sorry, yes, before the frontiersmen, the pioneers, the Christian ministers, and the pilgrims, the Quakers, everybody showed up here with their doctrines. Because it was a time when we didn't do any of those things. And because of the encroachment of our lands, because of the encroachment of the takeover here and the consistent decimation of our lands and the horrific killings of our people, we have got ourselves into a situation which is absolutely out of control. So I want to thank you just for the opportunity to speak what's on my heart. There's a lot of groups out there. There's a lot of recovery groups out there. Get with those groups. It doesn't have to be Sober Indians. Whatever you are led to, whatever unction is in your spirit that's leading you to, get with that, apply it, engage in it. You're going to fall down. You're going to go through it. It's going to be bad moments. There's going to be jail. There's going to be suicidal attempts. You know, you're going to drop the ball. But dust yourself off. Get yourself back up. No matter what it takes, fight. Fight. Sometimes I get on people's group, you know, I see somebody and I say, oh, I have a year and a half of sobriety. And all I say is, freedom! Because they're fighting for their freedom. That's all I say in those posts. They're freedom! Because this is a woman and a man, young and old, fighting to regain their footing, fighting to gain their lives back, fighting to have a better life for themselves on the journey. You're still alive. You still have, there's still opportunity for you. You know, it's funny. You know, before COVID-19, you know, I remember going through a casino. We wanted to see a concert in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And we walked through this casino, and my wife hit me. She said, Derek, I am so proud of you. I'm like, what? She goes, you didn't even look at the blackjack. You didn't even look at the roulette wheel. You didn't even look at the poker table. You just kept going. I'm like, you know what, honey? I didn't even think about it. You know, I didn't even think about it. You know, and we were staying over that night. And, you know, we were staying after the concert because my wife wanted to go dancing. And I remember going to the bar. And I actually said at the bar, I said, can I have two ginger ales, please, with some lime in it? Hey, could you put a shot of the grenadine? It's like a little coloring, a little, you know. Or I said, can I have a little cranberry juice with some ginger ale or some seltzer? And I come back and we have our drinks. That's our drink now, you know. And when we go out with friends before COVID, we go out for friends. They know we weren't drinking. But they know that I always got our cranberry juice with ginger ale, you know, or a Sprite, you know, or a Coca-Cola, you know. And some of my friends who knew me back in the day, they would laugh. They go, oh, Derek, look at you, brother. Look at you, man. Man, you come on my. I said, bruh, I was in school. My head was in the toilet. You know, I thought I had threw up my kidneys and my liver and my spleen. I'm telling you, if it wasn't for my boy and my daggone dorm mate, I'd have been dead. You understand? Bruh. And I relate those stories to people all the time. You know, now I get invited to, you know, before COVID-19, I was always invited to speak in men's groups. You know, I never called myself a minister. I never called myself a reverend or a pastor. Mm-hmm. I just say that I'm a soldier in the army of the Great Spirit. I'm a warrior for the Great Spirit. And however he wants to use me, whatever capacity, I do it. I have been blessed with the opportunity to speak to a lot of people. I let them call me anything they want to call me, whatever works for them. But I know where, you know, this journey has taken me. I have the opportunity to get to my destiny now. Get to your destiny, sober mm-hmm. Indians. Fight with everything you have, sober Indians. You have a great destiny. Don't allow anything to stand in the way of where you need to be. Fight with everything you can. If you need help, reach out. If there's something that you don't know, find it out by whatever you need to do. There's help. There's so many different wonderful groups out there that can help you, that will take you in and help you out. There's no need for you to go through what you're going through. I know. Because if I had 3 hours to be able to speak with Karen right now, you would learn a lot more about me. I'm just grateful right now to be alive and to have my health, you know, because there was a time I was not healthy and I was close to death. And by the supernatural power, I'm here being able to talk to each and every one of you tonight. And I'm grateful for this opportunity to do it because we're all in this thing together. You know, and if you don't think we are, guess again, because we are. Because some of you right now are going through a deep part of your journey, and you are failing every day. And I know that failure. I know what it's like to cry and to say, I'm going to do this, and then you don't do it. You know, the mind is a deep, deep mechanism, you know, and it could change you in ways you don't believe it can. But I'm grateful that I have my life back and that I walk in freedom every day. I affirm it on a daily basis. And when you hear these folks from AA talk about, my name is such and such and such, I am an alcoholic. I get that. You know what I'm saying? Because they're reminding themselves of where they were. You know, and when they get that wonderful, you know, coin, and they look at it, it's where they see their freedom and the possibilities of their future. So, Karen, thank you for allowing me to share. I had a great time. And, again, thank you for your wonderful platform.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for coming on. I believe that somebody out there is going to take something from this tonight, and I'm honored that you came on to talk.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, continued success. Anything I can do in the future, please feel free to give me a call. Call on me anytime. I had a great time doing this.
Thank you, and I enjoyed listening to you tonight. That was very emotionally charged, and you got that message out very, very clearly. I want to thank everybody else for coming on and listening tonight. So tune in. We will have more shows to come, and hopefully in the future you'll come back on and talk some more because
my pleasure
this
to do
was
so.
A very interesting. Thank you. Well, you have a great
night. You're
very
welcome.
And thank you again.
You're very welcome. Happy New Year as well.
Happy New Year's.